I'm Greg Johnson. This is Countercurrents Radio. And today I'm joined by Richard Spencer of the National Policy Institute and Matt Parrott. Matt and Richard and I are going to discuss Richard's recent speech at the American Renaissance Conference, which laid out a very big and bold vision of how white nationalist politics should play out in the near future. So, Richard, I want to welcome you to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on, Greg.
So let's talk about this speech. First of all, how did you end up on the AR program? I thought Jim Goad was going to be there, and when I checked in just a week or so before the event, I saw that you were there.
Well, so did I. I thought Jim Goad was going to be on the program, and I was actually kind of curious about what he was going to say. But I think Goad, and I don't know all of the details, I think Goad is a bit of a he's a kind of a strange guy, and he might not really fit in with this kind of material. And so I don't even know what happened, but Jared asked me to come off the bench and pitch hint. And I felt like, who was that, Los Angeles Dodger who was like injured and came off the bench and hit a grand slam or something in the 80s? Can't remember.
So are you saying that you thought that your speech was a grand slam?
It was.
Yes.
Okay.
Well,
good.
Well, it was
false
good.
Modesty is, after all, false. And by all accounts, it really was a very good speech, which is why you're on here. So
right. We want to. I was proud of it, and I think also many of the people in the audience really enjoyed it, and I think I did spur on a conversation. So I was very happy with it. And but anyway, I really have a great deal of respect for Jared Taylor. And, when I started reading American Renaissance probably around 12 years ago now, he really had a great effect on me. And he's probably one of the reasons that I'm, in this movement, in the sense that he allowed me and a lot of people like me to really think seriously about race. And to understand its importance, in the world. And so, if there's anyone I would come off the bench for, it'd definitely be Jared Taylor.
Well, that's great. I'm glad that you were there. Can you tell us a bit about how you opened the speech? I understand that you dealt a bit with immigration and why immigration reform and restriction really isn't enough.
Well, yeah, I think patriotic immigration reform is irrelevant and meaningless, and it is not something we should be spending our time on. And I think that is a bold statement, and I'm sure it was quite provocative for a lot of people there, because I think for as long as anyone can remember, we have been dedicating our resources towards immigration reform, whether it be kicking out the illegals or trying to stem immigration. And as I said in my speech, since we're in a marginal movement, something like immigration reform is almost our connection to the outside world. It's our way to feel relevant. We can work with some of these people and get this done. But as I was pointing out, in the summer of 2011, the majority of births in the United States were non-white. And the implication of that is that we could halt all immigration, legal and illegal. This would be the most miraculous victory for the immigration reform movement. And yet that would fundamentally change nothing. We would still become a minority in this country. And more than that, white people would no longer define the culture and the society of this country. In some ways, that whole 2050 date of whites being minority, we're there now. That's not some thing in the future where we're going to be 49% and the American dream will be over or something like that. We are at a crisis point now, and I think we've also passed the point of no return at which immigration reform is relevant. And I guess what I was talking about is that a lot of this immigration reform is kind of catnip for racialists, because we know who the illegals are. They're for the most part Mexicans, largely people of mestizo ethnic background, and so this has been a kind of it's been a proxy for us, a proxy for race. And but we, again, we really need to get over that. And I think we also need to kind of rethink immigration altogether. And I asked the question, you know, in the talk of what would we do if the South African Boers had to flee their country and come to America and seek refuge? These are the Boer boat people who are refugees. And the fact is, we should be welcoming people like that. That's actually a positive thing. That would probably help our economy and enrich our culture. And so, you know, we need to be very serious about, you know, what we really mean by immigration. And I think this all this kind of talk of immigration reform, because it's not focused on the real issues facing our race, and that is the presence of non-whites, this kind of you know, degenerate culture that we're descending into, we're not facing up to those real issues. That immigration reform is just some kind of escape valve, or it's some kind of lie or mask that we're going to wear. And I think we need to stop it. I think we're dedicating all of our resources towards something whose rosiest conceivable outcome wouldn't fundamentally change anything. And, you know, if we keep doing this, it is going to ruin our movement, because we will be dedicating all of our resources of time, energy, money towards nothing. And we need to make a dramatic turn. So that was, in essence, kind of the first half, or the critical half of my talk.
Well, that's really well put. I always thought, first of all, that you're exactly right, that immigration is a proxy for race. Mm-hmm. And then, to make it even worse, a lot of conservatives want to make illegal immigration a proxy for real immigration reform. And I always thought that that was a terribly foolish thing, because if your only concern is with illegal immigration and you put all of your money and organizational effort to getting out that message that we're against illegals, well, illegals can be legalized with the stroke of a pen, and suddenly all that effort is for naught. And all that money and time that could have been spent making the case against illegal immigration could have gone, if people had just more guts, really, to, you know.
Well, also, illegal immigration is far better than legal immigration in a way. I mean, one thing, illegals leave. You know, they're crossing the border both ways. And since the housing bubble started to collapse, we've had a lot less of them. And they're not voting. They are living in the shadows. I mean, that's good. And as you say, I mean, like, would anything change if, like, Jose is now legal Jose as opposed to living in the shadows Jose? Well,
oh, no, it'd be worse. You'd have the vote. Yeah, right. You'd have the vote. Yeah.
Right.
And all that time and energy that has gone into opposing illegals could have been put into opposing non-white immigration, mm-hmm. on the grounds that it will fundamentally destroy America's identity. And that has been done before in the 1920s leading up to immigration reform. They made all these arguments, and they made them so well. They avoided all the stereotypes of Nordic bigotry, mm-hmm. and things like that. They deftly sidestepped all of these red herrings and curveballs that are thrown at us today, and they managed to get that reform enacted, and we had it for 40 years, and it was a remarkable success. They could have done that. They could be doing that today, but they're afraid to, and they think that if they just use these proxies, they can somehow they'll be allowed to make their case. But even if they win, we lose.
Exactly. I would say a friend of mine was saying how, you know, what if we had dropped all this nonsense about, you know, constitutional amendments for gay marriage, or the flag burning, anti-flag burning amendment or something like that. And we had just focused our energy on finding a home for Black Americans in Africa. And that is, and let me be very clear about this, a very peaceful resettlement of Africans in Africa. And if you say that, everyone's like, oh, that's ridiculous, that's implausible. But if we had attempted that for the past 40 years, we would have gotten just as far as we've gotten with immigration reform, you know, or all these kind of things.
I think we would have gotten further, because that idea would have, I mean, everybody I know knows that there are people who have problems with illegal immigration, then they mm-hmm. might shrug at that or whatever. But imagine if every liberal I know were to understand that there are people who seriously propose sending blacks back to Africa. Yeah. It would be part of the cultural conversation. It would be something that no one would mention, but they would know it. And that would be progress over where we are today,
definitely. You would have incrementalists who are like, well, I'm opposed to sending them back to Africa, but creating a special reservation for them in southern Georgia or whatever,
right.
That's something I can stand behind. That's a compromise. That's sensible.
Yeah. And all these, and as I mentioned in my talk, all of these things really have been done before. I mean, Greg mentioned the eugenics and immigration reform movement and conservation movement. Remember, those are all the same people. They did amazing things, whether it be the saving the redwoods or Glacier National Park, which is, my neck of the woods. But also saving countless species, including the American bison, but also enacting immigration reform, creating zoos and, the Bronx Zoo and all these kinds of, they did amazing stuff. And, they made really bold cases, but they were ultimately able to capture the imagination of Americans. And I would also point out, as I mentioned in the conference, the idea of peaceful ethnic resettlement. Again, whenever you say this, everyone's like, oh, ethnic cleansing, and they have images in their minds of genocide and humiliation and domination, all these kinds of things, and understandably so. But if you look at the Paris Peace Conference of 1919, you had the so-called liberal elite were really captured by the idea of ethnic nationalism and self-determination. And, again, I it's kind of weird to be endorsing, Woodrow Wilson, not exactly one of my heroes, but, there are a lot of problems with all of this, but, it shows that idea of self-determination and ethnic nationalism can become relevant again. It can capture the minds of elite political actors.
Right. The argument that it's somehow inconceivable and totally unfeasible to mm-hmm. send these people back is refuted by the simple fact that it was somehow conceivable and feasible for them to come here in the first place, right? I mean, we could have a revolving door at the border where they could go out as well as come in, and if we simply enacted a legislation that would strip all the incentives to come here and mm-hmm. strip all the incentives to stay, they'd deport themselves. We wouldn't even have to know mm-hmm. about it. Mass movements of populations has never been more feasible than today. And mm-hmm. it's just a colossal failure of imagination and a failure of nerve that people who are concerned about white demographic destruction in Europe and the Americas and everywhere our people exist mm-hmm. are not talking in terms of sending them back. If it yeah. was feasible for them to come, it's feasible for them to go.
Absolutely.
So, Matt, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, today's been kind of a depressing day on Facebook for this topic because the gun bill mm-hmm. was shot down, which, no pun intended. And I'm glad about that. But there were all these things about, we're back. And this proves that we, fighting within the political system still mm-hmm. works. And yeah, I sort of hesitated to be a real downer there, but I realize that every time, and we will, every time we have some small victory right up until we're defeated, that victory is going to be used as proof that we can and should save the sinking ship. And mm-hmm. Looking at the demographic realities, well, once the baby boomer generation is off the demographic map, the whole gun right culture thing is gone. Even if young white people grow up to be even more staunchly NRA supporting than old white people currently are, there just aren't enough of them. One guy proposed that, we just need minority outreach. And I'm not that keen on the idea of encouraging our replacements to arm themselves personally.
Well, that's true. I mean, I think if we're going to take a quick digression on the gun issue, I think it would be worthwhile doing, because I think the gun issue shows this idea of people in America really just talking past one another. And because we're not willing to talk about what the gun issue is really about, and I think even the gun issue is ultimately a racial issue. You know, a lot of people, mostly white people who are supportive of gun rights, they often come from the Midwest or where I live out in the Pacific Northwest or the South or something like that. And for them, you know, guns are basically about hunting. They're about protecting your household. They're also kind of connected with a lore of, you know, maybe even the revolution or collecting the Wild West or something like that. And those are kind of the constellation of ideas that surround guns. For white liberals living in Manhattan, they don't have any of those. Guns are basically gun rights or gun control is basically about disarming dangerous non-whites living in their cities. And, you know, I kind of sympathize with them. Yeah. I think that the gun laws in Manhattan are pretty outrageous. But that said, I at least can understand their perspective. And I think, you know, the gun issue itself is something where we're not really getting to the heart of the crisis of our people and our culture. We're kind of talking about these hot button, you know, proxies that are kind of leading us astray and preventing us from really confronting the problem.
Well, exactly. I think that with the gun debate, a lot of whites who don't live in cities and some who do live in cities mm-hmm. want to have guns because they want to be able to protect themselves from non-whites. Mm-hmm. And I think that in a lot of liberals want to have gun control to protect themselves from non-whites. Yes. But none of us will actually talk about those anxieties and maybe deal with it in a more rational way, which might be, let's just take guns away from blacks.
Right.
I mean, that would be the most sensible policy. And the same thing is true with our drug laws.
Yeah.
Most drug laws on the books are proxies for racial warfare, low-intensity racial warfare.
It's a war on drugs disguised as a war on drugs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cocaine laws and marijuana laws are directed against blacks. Laws against opiates were directed against the Chinese. These were proxy racial warfare measures. And instead of simply saying, well, look, there's certain groups in our society that just go a little crazy and wild if these things are available, so maybe we shouldn't allow them access to it. We have to have this universal thing that impacts us as well, and it all stems from just a refusal to talk frankly about racial issues and instead deal with proxy issues, and also try and universalize these and make these into universal abstractions rather than target them at the real problems, if we would just admit to what the real problems are.
Yes. We're going to have a lot of agreement on this podcast.
Yes. Yeah. So let's talk a bit about the Constitution.
Sure.
You don't think that the solution is simply to return to the original vision of the Founding Fathers?
Well, we had the Constitution in 1789. And, you know, as I mentioned in my talk, we had a constitutional order. We had a much more Republican political system that was actually aristocratic in many ways. Confiscatory taxation was unheard of. We had it all. We had a bounteous natural resources. You know, I could go on. And we ended up where we are today. So I think whenever people talk about returning to the Constitution or something, I guess I have this idea of, you know, if you want to rewind your DVD and press play again, you shouldn't be surprised when it ends up at the same unhappy ending that we ended up at today. And of course, I mean, history is not determined like a video or something like that. It's obviously it's undetermined, but. At the same time, I think all of these issues, all of the things that affected the early America affect us, but even more so. I mean, they had a Negro population that were their political and social inferiors, and that was clear. And yet they still fought a civil war over this issue, killed 650,000 white men you know, for a war that was primarily over the presence of Negroes in this continent. And we ended up with liberalism anyway. So, you know, this idea of just returning to the Constitution, I think doesn't make sense. I mean, the Constitution is a legal formality. Again, much like immigration, immigration can be good or it can be bad. The Constitution is a procedural document. It can be good, it can be bad. I can imagine a mixed race, you know, horrible, impoverished, you know, Brazil-like hellhole of North America, and you know, we could have the Supreme Court, you know, just signing off. Oh, that's this is all constitutional. You know, it's just a legality, and it's not, you know, it's a means and not the end. We need an end. We need something that we want. We want to have a social order that we can talk about. This is how we want to live. This is how we want our grandchildren to live. And the Constitution is a kind of law. It's like, this is how, you know, we want the courts to proceed. It's not an ideal.
Well, I think the Liberia Project is, in my mind, the final answer on the merit of the Constitution.
Exactly.
And civic nationalism in general. Because they literally went there and pretty much photocopied our Constitution, photocopied our values, photocopied our flag. And we're like, we're going to do basically the same thing. And, you know, it worked out like it did with General Butt Naked running around eating babies. And, you know, I think that's all I need to know about the, you know, merit or utility of the Constitution, the big picture.
Well, also, just look at Western history. I mean, we have monarchical orders, authoritarianism, empire. I mean, a social order based on legality is something that's rare and probably completely unnatural to us. And you know, which society would you prefer? You know, Elizabethan England, which you know did not have a written constitution, was a you know authoritarian monarchy, or the you know great constitutional democracy of, you know, American Idol and, you know, Lil Wayne and Kim Kardashian, you know, I mean, it's just, you know, these kinds of things. And I'm not saying that the Constitution is really some bad thing or, you know, I think there's a lot that we should respect about the men who wrote it. It's just ultimately not going to save us. And I think we also should be willing to at least be very critical of the whole America Project altogether. And, you know, at the end of the day, it just seems so profoundly flawed when you look at the founding documents and the way they articulated their arguments. I mean, and it is true that, you know, Jefferson complained to King George about, you know, unleashing the savages on them and so on and so forth. But that you have the centerpiece of your argument, this supposedly self-evident idea that all men are created equal. I just feel like we really need, and this is maybe one thing that people like, you know, Countercurrents and Matt Parrott and Amran, like this is something that we are suited for because, you know, we are kind of marginalized, at least from the mainstream media. You know, we should be willing to go there. We don't have that much to lose. But I think this is one very important direction we need to head in. It's just a criticism of the America Project altogether. It's a kind of God that has failed. You know, creating a society based on these kinds of ideals and legality or something like that has not been something positive for the white man. It has been a way that we have been surrendering power. It's been a way that we have ended up much more degenerate than we were 250 years ago, at least culturally. And so I just think we need to be very highly critical of the whole thing.
Well, there's this idea that I'm being unrealistic when I abandoned my cornpone anti-immigration stick of my youth in favor of this more metapolitical death to America position I've taken on. Yeah, I'll say it. Matt Parrott says death to America. I want to own that. But what's really unrealistic, and the metaphor I would come to is like you're standing in your house, which is on fire, mm-hmm. and you're looking up and you see like the ceiling, you see where the fire is completely consuming the home. And you know, what's realistic, going through your same daily chores or, you know, trying to find your cat? Your house is on fire. What's realistic is to panic and act in an extreme, decisive manner. Mm-hmm. And that's what, you know, they're like, well, Matt, why don't you just focus on illegal immigration and these accessible issues where we can reach people? And, you know, as you very, very clearly framed in your talk, that is insufficient. This house is on fire, and, you know, that's really fine with me. I'm just trying to convince my friends and loved ones to get out of it while there's still time.
Well, I think the people who claim to be pragmatic are the most deeply impractical people. You know, and that's for the reasons that that, you know, that we mentioned before of immigration does not matter. I mean, we need to chart a new course, and we can obviously start to talk about that in a little bit. But, you know, another point that I made in my talk about this whole issue of pragmatism and so on and so forth is how unbelievably impractical the American project has become. I mean, I think creating, say the peaceful ethnic redistribution, sending Africans back home, something like that. Everyone think that's crazy. Well, that seems to be quite modest in comparison with, you know, ending the SAT gap or, you know, bringing democracy to Iraq and now Syria, or, you know, we need to inspire women to become, you know, astrophysics, physics majors at the very least, and soon Nobel Peace Prizes will be equally distributed. These are the kinds of things that strike me as just loony, infantile, and insane. You know, the idea that we can look back to the ancients with inspiration, that we can create a racially defined social order. These things are realistic and sensible in comparison with the total nonsense being pursued by the federal government.
I remember once there was a debate between Steve Saylor and Jared Taylor about civic nationalism versus racial nationalism. And my comment, I think I posted it on the AR site, this was going back quite a ways, was simply that, you know, Saylor was presenting himself as being more pragmatic. And my response is, I think that Jared Taylor is going to make white nationalists out of white Americans sooner than Steve Saylor is going to be making responsible citizens out of black Americans. It's our project is more realistic, more pragmatic, I think, than the egalitarian project that we're in. Mm-hmm. Nobody serious in the entire history of Western statesmanship or Western political philosophy has ever believed that you could strengthen a society by increasing the amount of diversity in it.
Right.
It would simply be laughed at by the saner men and greater men of our past. Mm-hmm. Even lunatic liberals like John Stuart Mill would have laughed at such a notion. It's simply a non-starter. Mm-hmm. And what we represent really is realism, political realism. Mm-hmm. And I've always been opposed to the kind of mainstreamers in our midst who think that what we need to do is we need to find some position that's close enough to the mainstream that can appeal to the people. I think that is a fundamental waste of time.
Mm-hmm.
It's a waste of time for this reason. Their underlying assumption is we have to appeal to the people and slowly move them in our direction. But the way to do that is not to shut up and blend in with Republicans and Tea Party types who are better funded and more famous than us and will get noticed. Mm-hmm. The way to lead people is to say something different than the misleaders on the right are already saying, the Ron Pauls, the Tea Party people, and so forth,
yeah.
Glenn Becks. And to do that, though, we really need to constitute ourselves as a cadre of people who have the skills and the character and the message to be leaders and to lead people in the direction of something real. The people will be there. You know, they're not going away anytime soon, despite the demographic shifts. The people, the public, are going to stick around, and they are going to need leadership. And the way to become their leaders is not to follow them. Right.
Yeah,
it's to make ourselves into somebody who's got a vision that's worth following, and that's a real alternative. And that's why I think that all of our energy really needs to go into creating a leadership cadre and creating a vision that we can actually put out there that is a fundamental and realistic alternative to multiculturalism, which will not work.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm reminded of the Herzl view, and I'm also reminded of Ezra Pound, that you need to shock the bourgeoisie. I think you do need to shock them out of what they think is possible and what they think is pragmatic. And by that, I don't mean to say things that are merely offensive or, you know, illegal and violent. I mean, I think, because actually I'm saying the opposite of that, because that all of that can be easily dismissed and put aside. I think you need to shock them with these you know, things that are rational and sensible, but are just outside of the paradigm, that really undermine the paradigm, and that they can kind of take a step back and start to think that other things are possible. And this is, you know, my talk, I was looking to Theodor Herzl, and who was actually kind of a founding father of Zionism. He was a journalist and was also a novelist. And he also spent a lot of his time fundraising for the Zionist cause, with, you know, very, very powerful banking interests in Europe and so on and so forth, with the Rothschild family. But, you know, his whole idea is the voluptuous idea. You don't want to say, oh, well, let's cut taxes by 20%, or, you know, it's like, no. The Jewish people, who were at the time really, you know, they were in a diaspora. You had some in ghettos, you had some that were highly assimilated, you had some that were quite wealthy, some that were so on and so forth. No, we're going to become a race. You know, we're scattered, we're headed off in all these different directions. We're going to become a people again, and we're going to rediscover our past and our culture and our language in this, you know, seemingly impossible project. And this was there's actually in a preface to his novel Alt Neu Land, which means old new country. You know, he said something to the effect, you know, Israel, if we don't wish it, Israel will remain a fairy tale. It will be some impossible utopian dream that some loony novelist had. But if we start wishing it, it will become reality. And it did become reality. And I just think that we need some people like, you know, yourself and some others in our movement to start dreaming this dream, to start wishing it and start talking about it. And I know this might sound I don't know how might this sound. You know, it might sound that we're just a bunch, you know, bohemian dreamers. But that's how these things get started. And when you start dreaming it, and when you start talking about it, and when you start thinking about it, it's like it starts to manifest itself in the world. And, you know, and I'm afraid maybe I'm turning someone off. This sounds too mystical or loosey-goosey or something. But, you know, this is how great projects get started, is that you have a telos, you have a dream, you have something you desire, you have a glimpse of a vision. And once you start channeling towards that end, you start working towards that end. And, you know, if you just think about this kind of bring it down to earth, so to speak. I guess it's kind of an ironic metaphor when you listen to what I would say. But if you just look at like John F. Kennedy talking about, again, not one of my favorite politicians, but if you just look at him talking about, we are going to send a man to the moon. Well, just saying that was a shocking proposal. The amount of money and time and expertise that were channeled by the federal government towards that end, that seemingly almost ridiculous end of just putting a man on the moon. You know, this was trillions of dollars. They created industries. They created, in fact, whole cities that were dedicated to this, to the Apollo program, this new industry. And they did it, unless you believe some of the conspiracy theories. But all of these things are very possible. We spent trillions of dollars bailing out Wall Street. I mean, for God's sake, we can spend billions towards this really beautiful project of creating an ethnostate. And I do think that, you know, this ideal should be, in a way, as impossible as possible. And what I mean by that is that, you know, I think sometimes when you talk to Americans, white nationalism or conservatism in general, it kind of seems like a step backward. It's like, oh, you don't want to be part of the modern world. You hate the modern world. You know, you want us to be less prosperous. You want us to be less cosmopolitan or literate. And, you know, it's like, no. The reason why our societies are degenerating is because we have some horrible, wrong dream about equalizing everyone and everyone's it will all be the same or something, you know, some whatever vision it is. No, we need a new dream. We need a new dream about we need an ethnostate so that we can explore the universe. You know, we need an ethnostate so that we can be more cosmopolitan and greater. That as opposed for white people spending their time, you know, trying to conquer other races, you know, the Aryan spirit seems it's gone to India, it's gone over the place of dominating. No, we need that's in the past. We need a new vision that we're going to conquer the stars. We're going to return. We need a new vision of eugenics where we're going to have a new race that is stronger and more beautiful. And more athletic than what we have now, so to the point that we'll rival the ancients. And so I think we need that kind of impossible dream, that is what is motivating to people. And also, that is why liberalism is, in a way, attractive. And, you know, we talk a lot about things like white guilt, of, you know, whites are taught to hate themselves and their past, and that is true to a certain extent. But why liberalism has legitimacy is that fundamentally it offers a kind of a vision of greater happiness and togetherness to people. You know, those leftists, you know, when they see that, you know, like stupid globe with all these multicolored people holding hands surrounding it or whatever, you know, you or I look at that, we're like, oh my God, that's so stupid. But that's kind of inspiring to them. And so, you know, we don't want to bring people realism. We don't want to wake them up and say, oh, this, you know, liberalism's bad. Oh, it all, blah, blah. We want to offer them a new dream. It's like, you know, with the ethnostate, we're going to have a more intelligent and beautiful population. With the ethnostate, we are going to explore the moons of Jupiter. You know, I think that is the kind of message we need to bring people. It's something that is impossible, that's voluptuous. That's a dream.
Well, that's very appealing. You know, when you're trying to hit the target in archery, you have to correct by aiming a little high.
Yeah.
And I've often thought that was a nice way of dismissing false pragmatism.
You know? Mm-hmm.
The false pragmatist says, oh no, you have to think small, play dumb, sidle up to the mainstream, and appeal to these people as they are now. Whereas really what motivates people and what changes the world are things that are more extravagant, contra-propositional, unrealistic, and so on and so forth. Those are the things that actually are the most inspiring. Muhammad didn't create his empire through pragmatic mainstream politics. He was on a mission from God.
Right.
And a lot of the people who have changed the world have changed the world precisely because they fought big. They dreamed big. And I think that we need to start doing that. So I'm in total agreement with
you. Well, a very recent example, and I'm on a smaller, more accessible scope, is Dr. Ron Paul. Yeah, and I think there are two lessons there as far as thinking big. I think he thought big. I think he, within the context, and ended up leaping for the stars and really landing solidly on the moon here, especially with Rand in the Senate and everything, and his base and the way the rest of the GOP is falling apart. But people didn't have ears to hear his message for decades. He, you know, all the stuff about inflation and economic instability and government debt, all sounded, you know, people just thought he was crazy. For years and years and years, until events around him brought Ron Paul to the fore.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, obviously, I think we need something very different than Ron Paul. I mean, Ron Paul is kind of like the conservative movement, only more so. And I think he's been, as all libertarians are, kind of sliding left on immigration, and you know, I don't think. You know, it's that useful, and I think we do waste time supporting that man. But
I fully agree.
I think you're making a very solid point, which is that, you know, he didn't want to lower the marginal income tax. You know, he wanted, you know, anarchy in our time.
He wanted to smash the Fed. He wanted to get rid of the income tax altogether, to repeal the income tax.
Yeah, yeah.
He staked out radical positions, and he waited for events to argue in his favor so that suddenly people had ears to hear him, and he had already worked out his message. He had an infrastructure. There was an intellectual infrastructure in the libertarian movement. There were actual libertarian political activists. There were think tanks and so on. And suddenly they had their day. And I think that we have to think that way as well. That is a good analogy in the sense that they were out in the wilderness sounding like they were from Mars for decades. Yet they kept building their own infrastructure and putting their own message out, rather than censoring themselves and co-opting themselves and trying to blend in with Republicans. And they had their day in the sun. People have listened to it. I think ultimately it's a bad idea. I think libertarianism is basically everything that's bad about the Republicans, minus pandering to social conservatives. And that's all that Republicans do to social conservatives. They just pander to them and steal their money. The libertarians don't even do that. They just push the rot gut stuff that will dissolve America without any kind of pandering to social conservative instincts. And I think that they would really just hasten the dissolution of the country because it is pure classical liberalism, and that is an acid for civilization. So, but anyway, I do think that his model has been very, very good, in at least in the sense that they had the courage to stake out a radical position and to hold the line and to create their own infrastructure for getting their message out. And finally, people did have the ears to hear. I'm waiting for white nationalists to follow that model because events are arguing in our favor all the time. Every day there's some new racial outrage, and we have to be slapping that same conclusion on every outrage, which is that if white people had a country of our own, this wouldn't be happening. And we have to get our vision of how that country is going to work out there. And I think that then we will be successful, because if we're right, this system is not sustainable and it is going to awaken more people to our message. So why not actually get out there and start putting that message out there rather than shutting up and blending in with the mainstream?
Yeah, and I think this also raises the question of how we do act politically, because you know, in many ways, my talk at Amran and, you know, what we're saying now, I think in some ways we're making this plea that, you know, politics is the art of the possible. And what we want is not, quote, possible, end quote. So we need to dream big to make it possible. And so I think that is our task at the moment. But this also brings up another question, which I don't know the answer to. So I would love to hear what you two have to say. And that is, how do we act politically? I mean, if we, you know, I think we can all believe, you know, in dreaming big and so on and so forth. Do we want to, you know, engage in the political process with something, maybe something like, or maybe literally, you know, the American Third Position Party, the American Freedom Party, that they at least have, you know, their board of directors seems to be really on our side. Is that the right way, or do we not want to play the game? We kind of feel like we can't win this game, that the game's rigged, so we're not going to play. And, you know, but how do we take action? I mean, I noticed actually another speaker at the conference, someone I got to know a little bit more afterwards, was Fabrice Robert from the Bloc Identitaire. And they do a lot of social action, so it's really not political action. But it's about having, you know, some protest, about having some, you know, socializing, having some, you know, torchlight parades and all that kind of stuff, where they really want to build up the camaraderie. And so I guess this is a real serious question about kind of, you know, if we are dreaming big, where we go from here, you know, how are our ideals going to manifest themselves in the world? And, you know, for me, at least, that's an open question, because I don't know the best way to go. I don't know if you guys want to add your thoughts on that.
Well, Richard, I want to argue for as much political disengagement as possible.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that happened in November is that the traffic at Countercurrent shot way up after the election and running up to the election.
Mm-hmm.
And it stayed up over 100,000 unique visitors each month for November, December, and January. And I think a lot of those people were disillusioned Republicans who were willing to start thinking and reading stuff that was more radical. And then I think around the beginning of February, you know, Rand Paul was filibustering and all this other stuff was going on, and they went back to their old tricks, right? They got sucked back into WorldNet Daily or whatever they were reading before. I hope it was WorldNet Daily, now that I think about it. But they got sucked back into more, you know, Fox News, Republican drool cup system politics. And I was disappointed in that, but I think that's inevitable. And I think that because there is such a strong gravitational pull towards the mainstream and mainstream politics, that we will never get anywhere unless we spend a good amount of our time just broadcasting fundamental political disengagement and cynicism directed towards the system. Mm. It is a rigged game. Stop sitting down at the table and playing another hand. It's time to kick the table over, and it's time to start thinking about some alternatives. Mm-hmm. So parties like the American Third Position and things like that, I would just say, don't waste your time. It's a trap. And what we should be doing is we should be doing metapolitics. And for me, metapolitics boils down to two things. First is honing our ideas and finding the media to get our ideas formulated in as many ways as possible to appeal to as many different white constituencies as possible and broadcasting them. And then two is forming our own alternative community. And that community really should aim at being the leadership cadre for our whole race.
Mm-hmm.
And then we want to form a government in exile, if you will.
Mm.
And an aristocracy, a new head for our body politic. That should be our goal. And the things that Bloc Identitaire are doing, the social activism, things like that, I think are very valid metapolitics in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
I think getting involved in party politics, though, is enormously expensive, and it is enormously disillusioning for people. And I just think that we have so little money, and the morale of so many of our people is hanging by a thread, that we just can't afford to have them throwing money into politics and getting involved in these things. And then, of course, they lose or they sell out, which is even more disillusioning. And I just think that we have to pull back from this, realize that we are not taking sides and fighting battles in America, but that we are forming the nucleus of a successor state. I think that that is the best way for us to act politically, is to disengage politically and start thinking of actually building our shadow government, our shadow community, with the assumption that when things get bad enough, the people will come our way. I do not think that we need to be constantly broadcasting to the mainstream so much as forming a really, really, you say voluptuous, or Herzl did, I want to say a sexy alternative, a very appealing, full-bodied alternative, and then people will come. I want to caution people away from mainstreaming and populism in the low sense of trying to appeal to the public as it exists today. Our people can be better than they are today, and I think that their eyes will be opened to making them more receptive to a better message if we make ourselves the people who have the message and are plausible as leaders. And that's really what we need to focus on first.
To paraphrase Greg, there is no white chair at the rainbow table. And we just need to not so much throw the table over as just walk away from it. And I think the next step after white flight, because there's really nowhere left to go, is sort of white rapture, in a sense, where and you have this vast panorama of political activity that's outside the conventional political framework. You know, somebody thinks, oh, politics. Well, I'll go down to my county precinct and I'll, you know, volunteer for the GOP or whatever. But politics is more expansive than that. Even if you don't go into metapolitics, it's more expansive than that. A reorientation away from believing in this commons, contributing to the commons, unplugging from the grid. A lot of these ideas are covered by national anarchists and the permaculture community and neo-tribalism, and a lot of this sort of rubs backwards against some of the conservative elements in our movement. But I really think those need to just be left behind in favor of sort of a crunchy back to nature kind of thing, where we learn how to solve our own problems, stop caring what the government does about immigration because it's no longer our government. Stop thinking, with like the gay marriage issue, stop thinking of legal marriage and your commitment and your marriage and your spiritual marriage and your church as being synonymous. I think we Anglo-Americans have such a long history of reliable government that we have conflated what's moral and what's right with what's legal and what's governmental. Mm-hmm. And I think that is what needs to be broken in favor of ghosting, of sort of disappearing from the system. Where did all the white people go? We need their tax dollars. Oh, well, they disappeared off into the wilderness and are using bitcoins or whatever for their transactions, and they're just gone.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's true, but at some point there has to be that's kind of a vision of a stateless society, but at some level you have to confront power. And I'm not against any kind of national anarchists. Keith Preston's a friend of mine. I like support these guys, but at some level we're going to have to deal with this. We're going to have to use the state for our ends. We are going to have to be
my final answer.
We're going to have to be in charge
at this step. I hope there will be a new grid in the future. I'm certainly not an ideological anarchist by any stretch. I'm not. I like to analogize it to we're sort of in a similar boat to the anarchist because there's a wicked stepfather. One brother hates the wicked stepfather because he's the usurper of the rightful father, and the other brother just hates fathers. So we're both against we're both against this father, but for sort of opposite reasons. It both involves figuring out how to get by without this guy and how to start living our lives and going about our business behind this man's back.
Mm-hmm. In terms of my framework, I look at what national anarchists and people like John Robb in his Sustainable Communities blog and things like that are talking about fits into the metapolitics framework, specifically the community building aspect of metapolitics. So I don't think that anarchism or national anarchism or dropping out or whatever is an alternative to politics, but I do think it is a metapolitical stage along the way, and that eventually, people are going to have to stop dropping out and drop back in because we will have to form our own state someday. Mm-hmm. A slogan that I used years ago, I think, when I wrote a pretty scathing review of Jim Goad's Shit Magnet is that I am for anarchy now and fascism later. And I really think that if we have anarchy now, we will end up with fascism later.
Yeah.
And I think national anarchism really does contribute to the community building aspect of metapolitics. And to that extent, I think it's really quite valuable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand. I guess there's just still that difficult question. And I certainly don't have an answer. And of just, there's that step of we rebuild our communities and our families outside of the system, outside of Fox, outside of caring about the politicians, blah, blah, blah. But there is that step that at some point, and it probably won't be literally us, but people like us will have to rule. And but I guess, I guess one could say that those things kind of take care of themselves. I mean, I think, something like that should be a necessity. It shouldn't be a this man must rule. We need these people to take power. We need these people to use power. And it will be a kind of historical necessity and not something that we, dream up in drawing rooms.
Well, the events will argue for that eventually. Mm-hmm. Because yes, you do need to confront power. You do need to take responsibility. There needs to be a state. a lot of our people will prefer to drop out, but they're not going to be actively opposing us either.
Right.
And I think that what will happen is there will come a situation where we will need a corporal from Austria or from Corsica or whatever to assume the reins of leadership. And what we need to be is we need to be the elite that can identify a person like that and groom them, right, mm-hmm. for leadership. Hitler did not arise from basically living in the gutter to being the Chancellor of Germany solely on his own merits, although he did to an extraordinary degree. In Munich after the First World War, and in Bavaria as a whole, there was a very powerful, well-organized, well-funded, elite right-wing subculture there.
Yeah.
And they had their various institutions like the Thule Society. A lot of them were organized around Bayreuth and the Wagner family. And these interlocking elites realized that they needed a way of putting into practice their metapolitical project with some kind of popular party. And they found the German Workers' Party, and they found Adolf Hitler, and they groomed him for success. We don't have anything like that today. Mm-hmm. If somebody with the charisma and organizational ability and the plausibility popped up in America today and said, I can save this country, there would be nobody who would groom this person except the enemies who would rush in with money and promises of aid to try and basically co-opt and sideline him. And so, again, I think it's really back to metapolitics. We have to have the ideas, we have to have the vision, we have to have the media, and we have to have the social infrastructure that can step into place, cultivate the talent, and eventually exert leadership. And events will argue in our favor, and there will be a time when people will be wanting a real solution. And I think that time will come. Maybe not in my lifetime, although I hope. Certainly I hope within the lifetime of people who are a generation younger than me. And I don't really worry about whether we're the numerical majority or not. Whites were a tiny minority in 1612 when my first ancestors arrived on this continent. And we got the whole thing. And I don't see why we couldn't, you know, become a minority and end up basically running things again. It's just a matter of will.
I agree. It's a beautiful thought to end on, perhaps.
Well, Richard, thank you so much. I really have enjoyed this. Matt, do you have any other last thoughts or last questions for Richard?
No, I enjoyed the speech. I thought it was definitely perhaps the most spirited speech of any at the conference. And that's high praise, because it was an excellent conference with a lot of very intense rousing speeches, especially for an American Renaissance conference. I think that's the consensus. Good stuff.
So, Richard, if our listeners want more Richard Spencer, where should they go?
Well, if you enjoy podcasts, I would direct you to vanguardradio.net, where we have a lot of conversations that are similar to this one. And we try to do that just about every week. My co-hosts there are Andy Nowicki and Colin Liddell. And we usually have spirited, bourbon-infused conversations. Although I don't really write there so much anymore, alternativeright.com is a good place to you can go check out some of my older writings and check out some new stuff. Also, MPI America. .org is where we have the institute, and we're actually I would really direct you there, because the site has been a little bit kind of like a sleepy little town for a little while, and I'm in the process of going to be livening it up, so I would definitely check out there. Or also radixjournal.com, where you could subscribe to a journal that that I edit, where we're actually in the midst of creating the second one and the third one. And also washsummit.com. It's where I spend a lot of my day editing the excellent writings of others, and you can kind of check out the books that Washington Summit Publishers has produced in the past, and what we're up to in the future. So anyway, all those places you can find me.
You remind me of Louis Andrews, who is a friend of both of ours. I remember SPLC published a hate map for Augusta, Georgia. And I think Louis ran like 4 out of 5 hate groups in Augusta. And you've inherited that mantle, and I'm pretty sure you're running 4 out of 5 things in the Flathead Valley. That's
that's true. Yeah, no, Louis was a great guy, and I certainly admire him. he kept the things running. But we need more people like this. I agree. We need a movement that's a big constellation where we're all producing tons of great stuff, and you can't keep it up. You can't keep up with it all. And you know, I think we've kind of reached that to an extent with a lot of blogging. And I think, you know, in terms of like HBD blogging, and I'm aware that Matt is highly critical of the HBD sphere, but, you know, there's just a ton of people doing it. And I think with, you know, Countercurrents, there are a ton more people who are thinking in this direction. And I hope that can metastasize to new organizations, new journals, more websites, more kind of stuff, so that we really have a movement.
It would be really nice to have a very, very deep bench of people that we can call upon for a lot of different things, for IT work, for writing. You know, I would love to have a whole stable of contributing editors, some guy who works on European prehistory and anthropology, another guy working on comparative religion, and another person working just on continental philosophy, and so on and so forth. That would be wonderful. And we do know people out there who have that talent, but a lot of their talents are divided between the movement and their day job, so to speak. And eventually, though, I think what we'll have is something that will grow large enough that there will be a whole number of independent think tanks and institutes like the libertarians have. They have the Cato Institute, the Institute for Humane Studies. They've got Reason Magazine, all these other organizations. We will have that kind of infrastructure because we already have a lot of the brains that could fit into that infrastructure. And every week now, I am finding new people who are graduate students or doctorates in various fields who are coming out of the woodwork because they read what we're writing and they like it. So I really do think that this is growing very, very fast. We just need to have the infrastructure to accommodate that growth.
We need the money, too.
We need the money. Yeah, that's another thing we definitely need. So, well, Richard, thank you so much. And Matt, thank you so much. This has been a really nice conversation, and I'll have this online on Friday.
Great. Well, thank you, Greg.
Thank you.